You always have delusions.
I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection to order. Now, colleagues, we're going to start out with a short public hearing on House Bill 2326 and then go back to the top of the agenda. And, Victoria, you want to give us a little brief summary of what the bill is to jog the memories of my committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2326 increases motor vehicle liability coverage required for property damage from $10,000 to $25,000 and certain personal injury protection benefits from $1,250 to $5,000 a month for lost income. We had Dash 1, 2, and 3 amendments, which we discussed on Monday. You have in your packets now Dash 4 and 5 amendments. I'm sorry, I didn't get a chance to get them included on the SMS because we just got them. So there you are.
Thank you, Victoria. And committee, we have dash threes, fours, and fives on this that have been brought by conversations.
And the tooth fairy.
Yeah. There's, I didn't call you that. So anyway, I just wanted to alert you to these different, they're just basically different amounts to the original bill. And we have signed up to speak right at the moment, Neil Jackson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is going to be very quick. We have looked at the dashes, and in fact, we did submit the Dash 4 amendment on behalf of OTLA. That's who I'm testifying for. Neil Jackson is my name. I'll just tell you real quickly. Of the three in front of us, 3, 4, and 5, we like 4 the best. We can live with 3. We can live with 5. Is that short enough?
Great testimony. Any questions of Mr. Jackson?
Yep.
Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Chair. Your amendment was Dash 4, is that correct? Was there some collaboration on these amendments? I guess that's what I'm looking for, is that we actually were working together to try to bring this. This has been quite an issue for us to look at.
I won't tell you that there's been direct collaboration. We had a discussion in the hall. There was no concrete proposals put forward by both sides. However, there have been different amendments suggested. We're getting closer. We're not kissing, but we're shaking hands, sort of. Grimacing, maybe, but shaking hands.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other... thank you, Mr. Jackson. I appreciate it. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on House Bill 2326 at this moment?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller representing the Property Casualty Insurers Association. We did just receive the Dash 4s, 5s, and 2s, and to answer Representative Matthews' questions, we have not had direct conversations on the agreement. I think we're getting closer. If the committee wants to move forward, I think what our objective was is to try to get on the wage, particularly in the Dash 5, I think, gets us closer there to some form of middle ground. And again, I think if you look at the reduction to 3,000, I think 2,500 gets us closer to what would be considered an actual, an average family income. And so if we're looking at some form of, instead of picking numbers out of the air, if we were to make some kind of a policy decisions on average, family income wage level versus just pick something out of the air, I think that's kind of where the conversations have taken place recently. I know as of this morning with some of the committee members.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Sean, what was the average family income 24 years ago when this bill first became law?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, I good question. I don't know.
If you could find out, I'd appreciate it.
I will find that out. I know the even the Dash 5s, we're talking about more than doubling what the current level is. Again, but I think an average, if you, I don't have a calculator on me, but I think 2,500 would be about 40.
But I wasn't asking you about the average income now. I was asking about the income 24 years ago. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate. So, Sean, if I'm gathering what you're saying, you're advocating for the dash six.
Mr. Chair, yes.
Chair.
Representative Krieger.
Sean, would you rather have it at 2,500 with indexing or 3,000 without?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I'd rather not have indexing. I know our members have expressed concerns about the indexing.
Yeah.
That was in, I believe, the dash three amendment, and that brings
two.
A lot. Two, I'm sorry. And that is of concern to us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sean.
Thank
appreciate
you.
Your willingness to come forward and testify. Any other comments from the committee? If not, it's my intention to carry this bill over till Friday. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2326. I'd like to open a hearing on House Bill 2369. Victoria, would you give us a brief summary of the bill before us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2369 establishes conditions under which insurer may settle with individual injured in motor vehicle accident, prohibits settlement which is entered into less than 60 days of accident, restricts insurer ability to recover personal injury protection benefits, and does not include clear statement of consequences of entering into a settlement agreement, exempts traffic crash exchange reports prepared by law enforcement from public records disclosure. And you should also have dash one amendments in your packet, which establish conditions under which settlement may occur within 60 days of accidents and strips the disclosure requirements.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Committee, a new bill before us. And first up, we have Dr. Vern Sabo.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if Mr. Merrill, Steve Merrill, could, he's going to explain the first part of the bill. Is that possible?
Oh, certainly. Mr. Merrill, welcome.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, once again, Steve Merle with State Farm Insurance. The piece of legislation you have in front of you is something that Dr. Sabo brought to us during the interim and asked for our input on. It got pressed into the current bill that you see in front of you, and we've had discussions since that time. State Farm favors the bill with the Dash 1 Amendment. What the Dash 1 Amendment addresses conditions of settlement and early settlement. What typically will happen in an accident is if I have an accident, somebody's responsible for the accident, I have a liability claim against them. And that's the claim that I'd be looking to settle. In Oregon, since PIP is mandatory coverage, I also have no-fault coverage through my own insurance policy that I collect my medical bills for through. Now, if your representative or whoever's representative that's at fault for this accident comes to me and I settle with them, typically I know that I'm releasing my claim and I can't sue that person anymore. What I may not understand is that in releasing that claim, I'm also giving up my no-fault PIP coverage because now I've impaired my carrier's right to collect the money back from the liability carrier. So the, Dr. Sable came to us. The concern was how do we solve the problem in early on in an accident where a person is able to settle, move on with their life as far as the liability claim, but be assured that if they do end up having some medical bills, that they're able to have those covered. What the Dash 1 Amendment does is it says if an insurer within the first 60 days following an accident settles a liability claim with that claimant, that settlement agreement has to include in its terms that it does not affect the personal injury protection carrier, the PIP carrier's right to collect their money back. That has the effect of the liability carrier is able to settle a claim, protect their insured, but yet the person who was injured, if they still have a need for some medical treatment, can go ahead and have that medical treatment. That's the rule that the Dash 1 would provide up to 60 days following the accident. 60 days following the accident, kind of our idea was that people should have a better idea of what their situation is. Is it a good idea for me to settle now or not, or should I wait till I'm able to get a doctor's advice and say I'm completely okay and can be released? And that's the change to Dash 1 do. The second part of the bill deals with a public records exemption, and Dr. Sable will explain that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the second part of the bill has to do with public records, specifically crash injury reports, such as what the City of Portland produces. What we have situation with individuals going to the city and getting a laundry list of the crashes that have happened in the last week or month, and then having an employee cold call those consumers directly to the point of harassment, multiple calls, in hopes of capturing them as a customer, client, patient. This came to a head in our Board of Examiners with one individual in my profession who had an employee who was calling consumers that had been in a recent car accident. Us being known to this employee, one of those consumers that was called was already a patient of another chiropractic physician, and that employee attempted to still capture that person as a patient for the person he worked for. That facilitated a complaint with our, and rightly so, with our Board of Examiners, and this issue came to the surface. I didn't realize that such activity took place. So our Board of Examiners wanted to go forward with this piece of legislation, but was given direction by the Governor's Office that it would be more appropriate for a trade organization to carry the ball, so that is why I'm here. And what it does is simply make crash injury reports not subject to public disclosure. If, in fact, you're the attorney involved, the doctor involved, the patient involved, you can get the report. But not just anyone off the street can come and get a laundry list of accidents and with contact information and start calling and contacting consumers directly. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that completes my testimony. I'd be willing to answer any questions.
Questions from the committee?
Sure.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just appalled. So are you saying, Dr. Sabo, that anybody off the street can get this information that's in an accident report? So it, in a sense, it can be what they call an ambulance chaser, even though somebody might not be in an ambulance. Just if they got in an accident, that would be public information if anybody asked for that.
Ms. Chair, Representative Tomei, members of the committee, that is correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions from the committee? Well, I have one, I guess. Have either of you heard from anyone that has opposition to this bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, not to my knowledge, there has been some discussion. Some concerns relative to the public disclosure piece.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, as far as I know, in checking with the insurers in Oregon on the Section 2 part of the bill, neutral is at least where everybody is, if not in favor of it.
Okay. Seeing no other questions from the committee, of you two gentlemen, I appreciate you bringing this bill forward and working together to try to hammer out any differences you had on the bill. And appreciate that effort. Thank you very much. Is there someone else that would like to testify on this bill?
Maybe. Chair Halvey, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. My apologies. I hadn't flagged this, but we do care about public records. And I say this cautiously because I've only re-reviewed this very quickly right now. There are two provisions of the public record. One is an outright exemption. You can never get this document regardless. And the other is you can't get it unless there's a strong public interest. barrier that you have to go over. We tend to prefer to see things in the strong public interest hurdle so that there's some give and take and not an utter exclusion of documents versus the outright ban. This appears to be being put in the outright exemption, the 502 section. And then I'm looking at the last page, and it talks about any person that has obtained a court order. And I'm looking at the last page, I apologize, lines 19 through 23, which seem to give sort of this public interest test, but through the court, rather than through the holders of the document, where it's usually when you make a public records request and they say, no, you can't have it, and you need to establish your public interest. So it's a little bit of an odd hybrid, and we simply just prefer it to be put in 501. So that it's not just a direct public record, but there is an ability when appropriate. Because, and I apologize, I don't know the scope, but it sounded like some of it's information about accidents and locations of accidents may be important for folks, not necessarily who was hurt and the details. So I don't know the scope of the information that may be contained in this, but it may be useful. And I could be wrong.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just because I know we're going to be going over something like this pretty soon with the ACLU, I think is what they're trying to do is just keep the ambulance chasers, as Representative Tomei put it, from calling these people. Because you'll get chiropractors, doctors, and they're just phoning up after the public records. So if there's a direction where we can protect the consumer or the person in the accident, that's what we're after. So you're saying the 501's the way to go, or?
Chair Holley, Representative Widener, and I'm sorry I didn't bring it so that I could be more artful, but yes, the 501 says this isn't a public record, or, if, well, let me look. Let me show you 502 if you look at line 16, because I'm sorry I don't have 501 in front of me. Line 16, the following public records, so see, it is a public record at the front end, are exempt from disclosure. The 501 says probably something to the effect of the following public record are exempt from disclosure except when there is a public interest established. So at the outset, someone couldn't just get it out of curiosity. They need to establish a public interest. And they've got that concept in here. It's just through the court. And I think it really, when we're talking about public records, we've got a process for public records that are exempt from the quick and easy way to get them. That's a public record, and you need to give that to me. But the agencies that control this and everyone, they've got a process to use, and I'd rather see the public interest test be done through the 501 than through the court order kind of hybrid version being set up here. And then, so yes, exempt from public records, but with public interest exemptions.
Follower.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question would almost be to Steve if he would be okay with that. Let the attorneys speak here.
Mr. Merle, would you come to the podium, please?
Sorry. Chair Hobley, members of the committee, against Steve Merle with State Farm Insurance. I was just talking to Dr. Sable back there. I don't think there's a disagreement of where we want to be. It's just the mechanics of how we're going to get there. And I think this is something we could work out fairly easily, that if you had to have a public interest, I think that would satisfy what Dr. Sable and the Chiropractic Association is trying to accomplish without any problem. So.
Great. Thank you. Further questions? Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. My comment is, are we going about this the right way? You know, it sounds like we have some businesses that are operating less than desirable. Are we making the right change to keep them from doing so, or are they just going to find another way to get the information? And so I'm just curious if we're routing this the right way. That's
Chair Holley, Representative Matthews. We've actually had some discussions about that, and I guess you could have some punitive measures for people who do this sort of thing. There are maybe potentially some problems with enforcing it, because there are some free speech concerns when people get information legally and try to disseminate or use it. Our thing that we keep coming back to and looking at the public record piece of it is, if you're limiting that access it's the curative approach to it as opposed to the or preventative as opposed to curative. And that's we keep coming back to. We have asked ourselves that question, and that's where we come back to is this is more preventative, and we feel like because of that will work better.
Other questions? I'm not seeing any. If you would stay there for just a minute. I've distributed a letter to my committee members that I received from Teresa L. Jennings from Reed Elsevier. I don't know if any of you are familiar with it. She deals in LexisNexis and with insurers and things like that. She had some concerns that I think may have been addressed by the amendment. So, but I'd like Vern Sabo and you, Mr. Merle, and Andrea, to take a look at this letter and take her comments into consideration as well, and see if we can come up with addressing the final issues that would satisfy everybody. I'm pretty hopeful that can happen.
Chair Halvin, again, I do want to extend my apologies to everyone involved for the late nature. That's the fun of being in this building. Sometimes you issue spot rather quickly, but I'm happy to work, and I do think the concept is the same. I think we just, and hopefully we can work it out by putting it in the 501 and making it easy for everyone to know the process.
No apologies necessary. It's a public hearing, and I appreciate you expressing your concerns. Any other questions from the committee? No, thank you. I appreciate you working and seeing if you can get something hammered out in a timely fashion or faster. And with that, is there anybody else that would like to testify on House Bill 2369? Seeing none, I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2369 and open a hearing on House Bill 2371. Victoria, would you like to give us a little primer on what House Bill 2371 is about?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2371 restricts situations in which private entities and governments may read, store, share, or sell information electronically retrieved from driver's licenses, permits, and identification cards. You should have Dash 1 amendments attached to the bill. The Dash 1 amendments define the term swipe and confine limitations on collection of data that is swiped from licenses and not obtained in any other way.
Thank you. And up first, we have Andrea Meyer from the ACLU.
Chair Halvey, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon, and this is why I'm here today. And I have the privilege, I think, of bringing some folks to the room that normally ACLU doesn't interact with a whole lot. I'm providing written testimony. I'm not going to read verbatim. I'm going to provide some highlights of the issue. ACLU has brought this bill forward, and the Dash 1 amendments are a complete replacement, so you don't have to hunt in text to look for the changes, and the focus is on swipe, and I'll walk through the bill in a moment. But the purpose of this bill is to prevent data harvesting from state-issued driver's licenses and state-issued identification cards related through the DMV. No other identification cards are at issue here. And this establishes restrictions, not an outright ban, on what private entities and governments from swiping the card and storing personal information without our consent. There are, and I should have brought my driver's license up as an exhibit, but I'm sorry, I apologize. I want to back up and say I am the only one here testifying in support of this bill, ACLU. Behind me are 16,000 members of the ACLU of Oregon, so it will be just me, and I have no PowerPoint display either to show folks. On your driver's license, there are two barcodes. The 1D barcode has the DMV-issued identification number and your date of birth, and the 2D barcode has all the other information that is printed on the front of your card, with the exception of the photograph.
So that is your name, your identification number. It also includes your date of birth, address, gender, eye color, height, weight, and any restrictions you might have, be it eyeglasses, if you're designated as a donor, and there may be some others. Some manufacturers of this technology, when I was looking on the web, actually promote that they can get your photograph and your signature off of the card as well. And swiping the card provides a very easy and cost-effective way to collect and use personal information, including unwanted marketing and data mining of all the information. And individuals should be able to choose who gets their personal information and how it's used. Driver's license should not facilitate the data collection of our shopping habits, of our lifestyle choices. For example, if you go into a bar and they swipe your license for age verification, and as I'll explain, that's permissible, most people then don't want to receive mailings from the bar promoting the bar, promoting products and beers and wines and things they sell. If the data includes that you have eyeglasses, you wear eyeglasses, selling it to another entity that promotes vision and other marketing schemes, they just came to the bar to have a drink probably and hang out. And that's all. So, as more personal information is amassed in more databases, it does increase the chance of information being misused or stolen. And attached to my testimony is some information about ChoicePoint, which is a data aggregator. And in 2005, they sold records of thousands of Americans to identity thieves, and it turned into cases of fraud and identity theft, and it included their name, their Social Security number, address, and birth date. Now, I'm the first to say that mass databases already exist, and there's no stopping that. I'm not here to say that we can stop the massive growth, but we need to start providing some limitations, particularly with a technology that is relatively new and is not, although there'll be some testimony of how it's being used, is not used every time you go to the grocery store or to a bar. Now, what it does, in a nutshell, is stop the surreptitious way of copying, storing, and using our personal information, again, without our consent. So I'd like to walk through the Dash 1 amendments. And the major change is that the original bill used electronically read and then define that. And that wasn't as artful and as narrow. So we've used swipe, which is defined in the bill on lines 15 through 19, the act of passing a driver license or identification card through a device that is capable of deciphering in an electronically readable format the information electronically encoded in a magnetic strip or barcode on the driver license or identification card. So this law doesn't limit businesses from taking information any other way off of your driver's license. So, for instance, many businesses and places collect information. You hand them your card, you're handing it, and they write down your name on checks and other things. And this does not stop that. And if that information is then entered into a database and transmitted, even for marketing, this does not affect that. It simply limits the ability to sweep up significantly more personal information in a data format which can easily be transferred or sold. Now, the prohibition on swiping is not absolute, and I want to walk through the exceptions. First, a private entity may swipe to verify the authenticity of the document, driver's license, or the individual. And if the individual pays for goods or services with a method other than cash, or returns an item, or requests a refund, it may be swiped. There's limitations on that. Get to a moment. Second, a private entity may swipe to verify an individual's age when providing age-restricted goods, services, or discounts. And I've already talked about, for example, bars. I did a ride-around with a Portland police officer in late summer, went into a relatively high-end bar in the entertainment district in Portland, and they had these new machines. They were very thrilled. I think they cost about $4,000 each, and they were able to scan the license, and this would not stop it. I asked them if they knew if they were storing it, and unfortunately, they didn't know. So, we would not want them to be storing and then selling it. Third, a private entity may swipe for purposes of storing, selling, or sharing this personal information in any way they want if they receive written consent from the individual. Finally, an entity may store and share The personal information, if collected from an individual, as I mentioned before, who pays with a method other than cash, but only for the purposes of preventing fraud and also other language in here, preventing fraud by pursuing legal remedies against or recovering a debt or security interest against the individual. And I'm happy to include for purposes also of returns to prevent fraud. But they can only keep it for 30 days. And that's where we're going to have a problem, I think, when the next folks come up to testify. But the 30-day limitation is important. We believe it's enough time to protect against the fraud at that moment, but that it, the point of the 30-day limit is to prevent a permanent collection of this data. By removing a 30-day limit, any business can evoke that they are reasonably collecting the information for fraud protection. And then they can use it for any purpose they want. And so not having the 30 days undermines the prohibition that this law would allow. There's, other than the exceptions above that I've just described into how they can have permission to swipe, a private entity cannot deny a person or goods, deny a person either goods or services for refusing to allow a card to be swiped. But I want to be clear. This does not restrict a private entity from denying goods or services if a person refuses to produce their driver's license or identification card or allow someone to take off the information off the face of it. The limitation on denying persons goods or services is only if they refuse on the swiping. And so if a business practice says, we need to see your license to return that or to sell you that item, this law does not give the individual an out, and a business can still refuse to sell them the goods if they don't produce a license. Now, we have a government limitation as well, but I think the exceptions cover all the expected and reasonable uses. So the government can swipe it if the individual knowingly makes the card available or it is lawfully seized. So I think any traffic stop, and if law enforcement starts using that technology, you are knowingly making your card available when the officer stops you and asks you for your driver's license. And then it also provides in emergency situations where the person is unconscious and unable to communicate. Now, the law does, in Section 7, allow for a civil penalty only. California's law makes it a crime, a misdemeanor, for violation of it. Rhode Island, which has a much more restrictive use, does create civil liability. And the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators has a model act, which was rather complicated, so we decided not to use that. But that invites both criminal and civil liability. So we think invoking civil liability here alone and not going to a criminal sanction hits the right balance. We urge you to pass House Bill 2371 as amended by the -1 amendments. We urge that limitations be set to protect consumers, particularly when it's detailed personal information and they have no idea it's being collected and stored. My Washington folks sent me an email just 2 days ago and said they had someone calling quite upset that a bar had swiped their information and they don't have a prohibition up there. And so, you know, folks are concerned about this, and they want to know when their data is being collected, and they want to agree to it. Now, I understand some folks have significant concerns about the issues of fraud and the cost, and I certainly recognize the cost of the state, the cost of the country, and the need to protect against fraud. And I'm hopeful that at least we can try to figure out a way to balance that. But if it's removing the 30-day limitation, that guts the bill and the concept. Because, as I said, any business can say, we are reasonably collecting and swiping this information to protect against fraud. And once they do that, they are not only able to use that data to protect against fraud, but for any other purpose. It enters that stream. And so there are no safeguards once we provide that exception beyond 30 days. So with that said, I'm happy to answer questions. I do appreciate the committee hearing this bill and really do hope that we can move forward with providing some protections to Oregonians.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Andrea, thank you for your testimony. As you know, I'm a former data analyst and love collecting data, but that also makes me a very strong
proponent of making sure that that data is used properly, not collected in places where it's not needed. But that was a comment. Now the question. What happens when we change our driver's license from having a stripable magnetic strip on it to having an RFID in it?
Jim, are you still here?
because what you've done is you've taken away out of the bill the protection against RFIDs if we happen to put those in, and made it just for the magnetic strip.
Chair Halvey, Representative Riley, absolutely agree with you, but ACLU will fight every step of the way to turn our driver's licenses into RFID technology, which allows individuals to use readers. If they're within a certain distance of a person, it would be very unsafe for every Oregonian. I'll particularly identify women if they're out walking and someone has a reader and can determine who I am and where I live. So that technology is powerful, and we hope that our licenses never use that. The Real ID Act, which we are opposing, which we believe will eventually be repealed, does not, despite all of what it did in the final rules, did not advance with RFID technology requirements for purposes of complying with Real ID. So we don't have that hanging over our heads with Real ID. And there'll be more conversation about Real ID and other sides of the building, hopefully this side soon. And then we just simply come back in and we amend the statute to include RFID technology if and when we ever cross that bridge.
Thank you. Good. I'm with you. I agree that having an RFID in my pocket and my driver's license with all my information is not something I want unless I have it in a lead-lined wallet. So I'm hoping that you'll be successful. If you're not, I'll expect you back to stop at this again. Thank you.
I haven't seen the proposal yet, Chair Riley, Representative Riley, so Chair Halvey, so hopefully never will.
Other questions?
Great.
Not well, seeing any. Thank you very much for your testimony.
I'm sorry.
Oh, did you have a question?
Chair, I'm sorry.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In this atmosphere, which you acknowledged, can you help me understand, and you gave some great arguments, I mean, this is not meant to be hostile. I just, in this atmosphere, why this bill on your priority list right now? Because, I mean, by this atmosphere, I mean the economy and burdensome, possibly burdensome for retailers at a time when it's not advantageous.
Chair Halvey, Representative Gilliam, first of all, I've only seen this used in bars in Oregon, so it came to news to me that in some returns that even businesses are using it. And obviously it's being sold and marketed and increasing use. So I want to say that at the front end. Why is it an important issue? I find more and more privacy issues are a very important issue to Oregonians and actually across this country, and very few organizations speak on privacy issues across the range of all the issues and identifying them. This is an area that we thought we could begin to make some attempts to modify, restrict in a manner that is, we think, is reasonable and appropriate. Again, it doesn't undo the mass data collection, and I'm not sitting up here naive enough to suggest this is going to fix the problems, but I think particularly without consent is a real issue. And so, adding that and the consent issue, people want to know and agree to give something. Folks use the Fred Meyer help me out, the card, and I forget what it's called, rewards card. So Fred Meyer and other businesses have rewards cards. And I choose not to use it. If I did use it, I would get coupons and other discounts, probably marketed actually to my buying habits. But I give up to Fred Meyer and however else they may choose to use it, what I shop, what I buy, and it's none of their business. Now, I have that choice, and they don't deny me the service of getting the product at the same price. Others might have that hook. So I'm not sure I'm fully answering your question. It's certainly not our intention to undermine the economy, the business, the fraud. And if we can come to a way to segregate out this data, restrict the kind of data, because again, for purposes of fraud protection, they don't need my height, my weight, my donor status, my IGOS, and all that information. Now, I think people's names and addresses and even date of birth are probably out there in a gazillion databases, Representative Riley. This one particularly adds some details, and it wouldn't always be accurate about our weight either. So that is why, and we want to move forward with the privacy agenda, and we are, because I find that about half the time I'm here, I'm speaking on privacy issues. Does that at least partly answer your question?
Follow up, Representative Gilliam.
I mean, maybe her follow up. She's asking me a question. I don't know how that works. Follow up. Okay.
A yes or no question.
Maybe. I appreciate that. I just don't know how it fits in a priority scheme of what we're looking at. Okay. Fraud, what we're looking at, I want to be very careful to pronounce my INGs, and I feel like we probably need to start in our own house, if you've examined some of the material about our own records, by that I mean the state of Oregon, in terms of protection and fraud, and I would rather start looking at the Secretary of State's office and how we plug some of those before I start this. But that's not an answer or a follow-up, and I now conclude. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, Representative Holvey, Representative Gilliam, I think how ACLU looks at this is, you know, there's a balancing and there's policy issues. And so you've got the fraud issue and what steps businesses take, what steps they used to take, and now there are even easier steps, and there'll be even easier ones. You probably won't have to remove your license from your wallet. And where we start saying too much versus the interest of the consumer and the individual and the Oregonian to have privacy and control over their data until they have to give it up or they consent to give it up. You know, yes, the government requires us to give up data. And the private sector in some cases too, but that's where we ACLU looks at it, is the interest, the privacy protections, and the consumer protections of Oregonians in ensuring that they have some, albeit limited, control over their personal information. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions.
All righty. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for your testimony on this bill. Next up, we have John Ledger and David Justice. And Mr. Craven. I believe it's Jim Craven, right? If you'd identify yourselves for the record, whoever would like to start.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm John Ledger, Associated Oregon Industries. We house the Oregon Retail Council, and I'm here today. Normally, I wouldn't be in front of you. It'd be Betsy Earls. I do environmental stuff, but she couldn't be here, so you're stuck with me briefly anyway. A couple of things just want to lead off on this. You'll notice on the sign-up sheet, we didn't check we're opposed to it or we're for it, because we think this is a bill that lends itself to being worked out. It might take a week, but this is something where you hear certain words are really critical, certain protections are really critical, and we think this is something where if people sit down, chances are they can come up with something that's livable. You heard the California statute referenced. My understanding is the California statute would be fine. You also heard that things are required or not required. My understanding is stores are not required to take things back, but they do, and they like to, because it builds good customer goodwill. And people aren't required to give their license, their driver's licenses either. They can ask to see the manager. The problem is, of course, over the years, especially with the recession, the problem of fraud and abuse on take-backs has become really, really severe. And it's hurting Oregon retailers, and it's hurting Oregon consumers who this cost is just passed on to. So really, if they're unable to use mechanisms like we're talking about here, it kind of boils down to, you know, three things. One is that the retailer must become ever more restrictive about return policies just to protect themselves and the costs. And you might hear some examples where some of these frauds are extraordinarily creative. I mean, in a way, you have to admire them. They're so smart. As more money is lost to fraudulent claims, retailers have to cut costs, sometimes reducing jobs, and of course the customers are harmed by higher prices. So we think this is something that's very serious but can be dealt with if we're careful about how we adopt the language. And I'm very pleased to have with me today Mr. David Justice to my right, and he's visiting us from California, where they are in worse budget shape than you are, and they're locked down, as a matter of fact, last I heard. And he actually operates a firm that does this type of service. And it's my understanding this bill, this type of bill, would actually make him unable to provide that service to Oregon retailers. Many of them would be in your areas that might be small. This helps protect them, and it helps consumers. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Justice, if I may.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dave Justice. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for a company in Irvine, California called The Retail Equation. I also double in consumer affairs, which isn't my primary means, so please bear with me. The Retail Equation offers services across to retailers across the country to manage their return authorization services. And we act as an outsourced extension of each retailer's merchandise return authorization service and function in stores. We are here present in Oregon in retailers such as AutoZone, JCPenney, Nike, etc. And in 2007, the amount of losses because of return fraud and abuse was just over $15.5 billion nationally. And that's a 6% increase from the previous year. Specifically here in Oregon, it was $192 million in 2007. And so assuming about a $30,000 annual position, that's roughly 6,400 jobs in retail that are negatively impacted by this practice, which our technology prohibits. And all this relates to Bill 2371, because Bill 2371 would prohibit companies like ours from retaining this information and using it as a service. That would hurt retailers here. It would hurt Oregonians in the way of jobs. And we hope you would understand this consider this in your decision. Specifically with House Bill 2371, the language that is the most troublesome is the requirements that limit the retention of the data to 30 days. I just wanted to call out that that's even if the consumer consents to providing their driver's license. In our retailer stores, the consumers are given the opportunity and notified at the time of purchase that their ID will be required at the point of return if they decide to make a merchandise return. So the consumers are notified at the time of purchase and ultimately given the decision about whether or not they want to make a return at that store. So to the point of consent that my colleague raised, the consumer does consent to giving their driver's license. To the point of customer service, the way our service works is if a consumer is denied a return, the system generates a denial receipt, which prints out a 1-800 number, and the consumer can call our customer service department and find out specifically what data that the system has on them and what information was used specifically to make the denial decision. They can also get a copy of their return activity report, which is much like a credit report, and they can dispute any information that is on that report. And we'll act as an intermediary between the consumer and the retailers to resolve that dispute resolution process for them. And that's the end of my testimony.
Representative Riley, question?
Yes, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you go through for me a typical denial and why it might have been denied and why you need to keep certain information to do that?
Sure. So, Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, the way our system works is to gather information specific to a consumer's individual return activity. Some of the types of frauds that we see, or fraudulent activity that we see, are often people stealing merchandise at some point in the supply chain. And the way they monetize that theft is by making merchandise returns. So they take the stolen merchandise, they return it, they get the original sales price plus the tax back. And without the specific information about that consumer's return activity, the retailer only knows that they sell that item, and therefore they would have to receive that as a return if it's within the required time limits. So the typical types of scams that we see are those types, very frequent, so people spending 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, just making returns. Another scam that we saw recently was a husband and wife couple who traveled across the country. In about a year and a half, they took Walmart for over $1.5 million. And the scam was one where they would go into a store, buy, for example, a $6 pillowcase, detach the barcode from the pillowcase out of their car, take the barcode back into the store and reaffix it to a comforter set that's, for example, $400, $500. Purchase the comforter set for $6, go back out to their car and reaffix the original tag, which was $400,
$500. Slow down.
Sorry.
let me
Representative Riley, a follow-up.
Yes, please. Let me stop you there. So what pieces of information from our driver's license do you need to store in order to enable you to do this?
Primarily name, driver's license number, address, and date of birth.
And, follow up, Mr. Chair, why do you need anything other than driver's license number?
We use, Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, we use information from the clerk, for example, to correlate patterns of activity. So if we, if the system's algorithms see that an individual with the same last name as the clerk is making 30, 40 returns a week to that specific clerk, and they have the same last name, and they live at the same home address, there's probably a red flag.
I would think if they made more than one. Yes, okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, sir.
Thank you.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not familiar with this activity, so bear with me as I try to figure it out. Because everything I've ever returned, it says your receipt is required in order to return it. So stolen merchandise, it seems to me, would be a little short on sales receipts. But from what I just now heard, you're saying that the scam involves going to someone within the store system, the retailer system, who is accepting this merchandise for...
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative Cowan, receipt fraud is a big problem in our industry. Making fake receipts is a common practice. In fact, there's websites where you can go on and buy specific authentic receipts. Its practice is called shoplisting, and the scams are such that for 25 cents or a dollar, and we can provide you these websites, you can purchase these receipts and then take them to the store. And what crooks do is they take them into the store and shoplift those items. And what they figured out in California is that if you haven't removed the item from the physical store, you can't be arrested for shoplifting. And so what they do is they go in with those receipts, they take the item off the shelf and take it right to the return counter and monetize the theft that way. If they get caught, they have to just throw them out of the store. They can't arrest them for shoplifting.
I apologize, Mr. Chair, for not fully understanding this process.
if I could just add real quick, I buy stuff and I never keep receipts. My wife takes a lot of it back, so evidently you don't need receipts a lot of the time.
And that's a common activity. One of our value propositions, Representative Cowan, is that we can provide our retailers with the ability to accept non-receipted returns. Because through monitoring the activity, we can determine which returns are fraudulent or abusive. We can make the process much more easier for good consumers like yourself who may forget a receipt or lose your receipt. Your return is still accepted because your return activity is that of a good consumer.
Thank you.
Representative Widener.
I'm going to go the other direction here, because I know Representative Gilliam's set to go to town now. But on the personal information side, this is something I have troubles with, too. And I guess my question would be, what's the minimal amount of information you need? Because there are so many things. Putting myself in the retailer situation, I see the benefit of having all of this, because now I know buying habits, targeting, you know, my sales force or my advertising force to consumers. So it's very powerful, this information that you're gathering.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other side, I don't want people watching my shopping habits and tracking what I'm doing without my permission or consent. So what would be the bare minimum of information you would need for that return? Because when you give out driver's license, you give out your height, weight, and everything else. I know if I call my bank for verification, they'll say, well, when's your date of birth? When's this? And knowing how much employees are getting paid, and being someone who's had their credit card actually, or not my credit card, my debit card, hit by a place in Florida where they gathered my information, and it was somebody who worked at a spot or a location, they had all my personal information because of this type of activity. So we need to find a way to protect this. So it's a much bigger issue that we're looking at here. So right now I'm kind of siding with the ACLU, and I told Andrea I felt funny, but she took she took to heart what I was telling her and had that in these amendments. And these are things I'd like to see us address, where we're given just the minimal information that you need to do your job, but protect the consumer from being attacked, because that's our job up here, is consumer protection, and it's protecting our people in the state of Oregon. So is what I'd like to see from you guys, the bare minimum of what you need, and work something out to where this is going to protect the consumers in Oregon, but protect the businesses in Oregon so they can thrive and do well as on the other side. And I would like to hear your explanation for the best way to do this.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, so to the question of, you know, what the minimum information would be, name, driver's license number, address, and date of birth are sort of the minimum fields that we would need or prefer to run our service. And the problem being, when that consumer is denied a return, when they call our customer service desk, we have to authenticate who that consumer is before we can provide them with the return activity report. And so with having those four fields of information, that gives us comfort that our system can operate, you know, as needed, and we can authenticate those consumers as we need to. As those fields get pared down, it makes our service less effective, because there are certain people who now have been denied a return and can call in, and if they can't give us, you know, if we only have two fields of data, if they can't authenticate with those two fields of data, then we can't provide them with a return activity report. So ultimately, we need to uniquely identify that consumer, and the more fields we have, the better it is. Our recommendation would be those four fields of data.
Really.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One final question. What else do you do with the data?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, we only use the data for fraud and return abuse prevention. And so
you don't sell it?
We do not sell it. We do not use it for any other purpose. And actually, we have proposed amendments. I don't think that have been shared with you yet, but we're specifically requesting to obtain and use this data only for fraud and abuse prevention. And so to the point of Andrea, and I think Mr. Vice Chair, the issue that's driving some concern is usage, and specifically usage around marketing. And so the carve-outs that we're asking for would specifically limit the usage to fraud and abuse and other criminal activity.
Mr. Chair, I said final, but I'd like one more.
Final, Representative Riley.
Thank you. And that is, and I'm forgotten my question now, but I guess the last thing is, do you foresee having to store this data longer? Oh, there are two more things. The length of time that you need to store this data, if you find that this is not a person who has a return history, that they're not someone you're looking for, and finally, what's your security for the information? How do you secure that information? Those are the two items.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, to the first point of the time period for retention, we have done several studies on that, and it's if the retention period is anything less than 3 years, it deteriorates the value of our service significantly. So sort of to the first point. To the second point, in regards to security, the way our system works, the information is captured at the point of return. It's bundled into a secure data record that is encrypted and sent in an encrypted fashion to our state-of-the-art data center. Within the data center, it's housed under three-level protection, where there's physical safeguards, lock and key, and biological check, a thumb scan. So in order to get into the information, you have to pass those three levels of security, and then it's in a locked cage within that secure data center. So we are sort of taking the most extreme precautions as it relates to information security. We're also compliant with PCI standards, which are payment card industry standards, also compliant with ISO 1779. And we sell our service to these retailers because we believe we do a much better job at security, specifically information security, than they would otherwise, because that's our business and that's our core competence. The last point I would just like to raise is with systems like ours, there's no information that remains behind the counter at the return desk. Without electronic systems, the retailers are left to gather information manually or on pieces of paper, and it's left for ID theft, available for other folks, available for the clerk. Our information is never stored in the clerk. It's as I mentioned, encrypted immediately and sent to our secure data center.
Sorry for all the lengthy questioning, but thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you.
Before you get started, Mr. Craven, I just wanted to ask something. Maybe it's not really a great question, but recognizing that you go through a pretty rigorous, it sounds like, methodology of securing that data, you're one business in an industry that's got millions, and so we're not hearing from others who may not use your particular service but also store this data. So I don't know that that's particularly addressed in this bill at this point.
Chair, before we move on, thank you. Mr. Justice, I'm sure you've seen the article that ACLU presented to us about the situation in California with Choice Point. I mean, that's just one incident of information that has been shared in a very serious way. So, I mean, I'm hearing what you're saying. This is encrypted, et cetera. But we've heard this over and over again about information that had been encrypted and was so supposedly secure, and it's not secure. So I guess I share the Vice Chair's concern about all this information going out that is supposedly secure, but we have no assurance that it's secure. Supposedly it's secure, and then later that's a lot of information that has been made public that is very, very private information for us. So do you have any words of wisdom for us that can assure us that this won't happen?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, there are other certain states that have taken the payment card industry standards and legislated those into law. And if security is of interest or of concern, that might be something that the committee look at. But beyond that, I'm not sure what else I can offer other than we have taken proactive steps and adopted the most forefront standards for our business in the hopes that other businesses would do that as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just looking at this, I think this is much bigger than what we're dealing with just in this bill, because there's definitely security things that need to be addressed here, and it almost seems to me like we could almost put together a work group over a year on doing this, because both sides of the fence, if we start writing it down like you were saying, people gather that information very easily, and that's the problem that I ran into when my identity was taken. When you scan it, as long as it's gone from that machine and then left to your center, that's something I'd feel more comfortable with, and then limit it into like three fields or four fields, something like that. And I think that's probably something that maybe we should get at when we're addressing this, and maybe look at reworking this whole scenario that we're dealing with at this point. And I'd be kind of anxious to hear what Andrea's opinion is on that, as well as the three of you, because digital security is a big, big problem, and it's something our state doesn't do very well. And there's lots of companies and banks are probably a little more on the forefront to that, and I'd like to know where you're at technology-wise, and I work with companies that are at the same level, but we need to look at protecting information much deeper than what we're dealing with here, and I would like to see a proposal or ideas from you guys on how we could do that in drafting legislation to protect consumers.
Mr. Craven.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Craven representing a new word for you, but an old client. Tech America is our new national association. It's the result of the merger of AEA, who I've represented for 20 years, and another group called ITAA. So from now on, you'll be hearing me as Tech America, and that's our new group and a combined national trade association representing the high-tech industry. We've been active in these debates, you know, at the congressional level, in this building, all around the United States. And it's I guess the first thing I want to say is that everybody in this room, I believe, is on the same side. The other side are the crooks, the fraudsters, the people who are mining data, the people who are breaking into databases, who are stealing IDs. I mean, that's the other side. We have nuanced angles, I think, in this building and on this bill, but we are on the same side. I think we all believe in protecting consumer data and finding the difficult balance as the digital technology moves ever rapidly forward, finding that technical balance, that admittedly difficult balance between providing you all the benefits you get of the digital age, the ability to swipe a card instead of having to write out a check when you're at the grocery store, and the ability to buy things from Amazon.com online. I mean, there's lots of benefits, and with those benefits come difficulties and come a lot of fraudsters and a lot of crooks, admittedly, who are out there. We are trying as hard as we can to stay even with them while they keep pushing the envelope. I mean, any of you who, and I hope all you do, have a virus checking software on your own computer, the new threats are in the thousands per day, per month. And that's why you should have that thing running all the time, checking and updating your virus profiles, because the bad guys are inventing new things on a daily basis. So having said that, our concern from Tech America, we, on this bill and on other bills and other discussions, we want to sort of help you wrestle through that issue of the balance between technology and how data is used. We like to say that your main focus ought to be on those who misuse things rather than on the devices themselves. That's not so much an issue with this bill itself today. The ACLU's bill does not ban the technology, does not say how we should make scanning machines. It talks pretty narrowly about a set of data retention issues, which I think you've fleshed out here today. To Representative Widener's comment, we did last session, in the 2000 session of the Oregon Legislature, passed a fairly comprehensive data security piece of legislation, Senate Bill 583, which had a number of items to it. Notification if you have a data breach, if some of you remember this, restrictions on the use of Social Security numbers, the credit freeze Jamie's issue about how you can freeze your credit account, because that's one way that bad guys come after people. So we did pass that bill. It was a result of a year and a half of work prior to last session, and came in really with no opposition passed. I'm not sure it had a no vote on either side of the building. So we've made some progress and had a lot of people in the room for a couple of years prior to last session to pass that legislation. I've learned stuff today that I didn't know existed. I didn't know even companies like this existed. Turns out that David's company is a member of our national association. I met him at lunchtime. He really came here on behalf of the Oregon Retail Council, but turns out that he is a member of Tech America. So, you know, I want to support him in the request that he's made. I think there are two kind of issues here, and we could move forward in trying to make some fairly modest changes to the bill. Do we talk about the information fields, do we try to limit it that way, or do we talk about minimal uses of the information? I'm not sure the exact answer to that, but some of the scratching on an envelope that Mr. Justice has done would narrow to who can do this and who can retain the data. And, of course, from his company's point of view, it's people who are trying to work with retailers to prevent fraud and find, you know, evildoers who are out there trying to rip people off. So I think, it would be my request today that I don't think this is something that this bill itself, bigger, broader issues admittedly out there, but this bill itself, I would think people of like mind could get together in, you know, 4 or 5 days. I don't think probably by a work session Friday, because I know the bill was posted for Friday, but I don't think it's something that gets dragged out for, you know, an interminable amount of time. If we could find that balance that keeps Mr. Justice's company in business in Oregon so he can help Oregon retailers, but maybe precludes marketing uses. These are things we need to talk to people about, but I think we could find that narrowness. It's the flat 30 days for the kind of business that Mr. Justice does that really is the nut of the objection. I think we support the Dash 1 amendments. We think they improve the bill, and we'd like to just improve it just a little bit more, if that would be the something the committee and the chair would be amenable to. So, thank you.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to ask Mr. Justice another question, if I may. Why did you feel like you needed 3 years to keep this information?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, we have done studies of fraudsters and their activity, and based on the activity, if the shorter we make that window, if you think about the value of our data to our retailers, it's identifying the bad guys. So the sooner we let them go, the sooner they start to cause losses at our retailers. One of the things that the steps that we've taken from a security standpoint is to silo the data by retailer from a security standpoint. So one of our customers doesn't know the next customer's bad guys. So from a security standpoint, that's very good. From a business standpoint, it hamstrings us a little bit because we can't share bad guys' lists between retailers. We don't, because it's better from a security standpoint. And so the sooner we let that information go about those bad guys, it's essentially like wiping the slate clean. We then have to compile the data again. And there are sort of...
Mr. Justice, I'm going to stop you there. So you gave us an example of somebody went to Walmart and got a pillow slip and then kept changing the barcode. So if someone were doing that, I mean, they would continue doing it. So it isn't like I do it this week and then I'm not going to do it again for 3 years, right? So, I mean, I'm just having a hard time getting my brain around 3 years.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, it's often the case when these bad guys go to prison for a short period of time, and that time period, then if we had to wipe their data clean while they're in prison, we wouldn't know when they got out that they were bad folks again. So it's...
I have a hard time with that. But
okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. and with respects to Representative Tomei's comment, I think what's happening is we're kind of clouding this issue. This issue came to us as a very much concern from a group about identity theft, really, and storing that information. It's turned into a conversation about how to protect the business from fraud, which I agree is important as well, but really, you know, to get back on track of what the original concerns were, it's about people having their information taken, stored for whatever means, and I commend you for the company that you run and the security you go through, but it's far too easy for other people to gain access to that. So that's the original intent of where we're at with this bill, and I respect where you want to go as a business, and I appreciate that, I really do, but I think we're getting a little bogged down on the fact we're losing focus of protecting the people's right to their information and which information is privileged. And I think you're spot on in that it's what information we're going to limit access to is going to be a real key critical point with this bill.
Mr. Chair. Jim Craven for the record. Thank you. And maybe we weren't all clear enough to say that we're not here today opposing the bill. So if that was confusing at all, that's not what we're here today. We do not oppose the bill. We do not oppose the bulk of the Dash 1 amendments. We actually think they make the bill more specific and improve it. And we're all on the same side of protecting consumers' information and that delicate balance. So I did just want to say that. And we're if we can find some language that's very narrowly drawn, helps not say protect Mr. Justice's business, protect the people that he's working with and all their businesses, that's what we'd like to try to accomplish.
And follow, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
And I want to be very clear. I want to protect Mr. Justice's businesses who's acting accordingly and doing the right thing by that. I just am afraid we're also in a world where that's not the case throughout the land. But, you know, good for you. And I don't want to impact your business in a negative way. I just want to make sure we're protecting our consumers. Right. Thank you.
Seeing nobody else jumping up, I appreciate Representative Matthews' comments because I think our conversation did go a little bit to your point, and which I do appreciate. But I think underlying this whole issue is the use of a consumer's information out there that somewhat jeopardizes their rights to privacy and their personal information. I am sometimes shocked at what I get in the mail addressed to me specifically about the goods and services that I've purchased in the past. And I know that that information is not getting to them because somebody's been trying to protect their business from fraud. It appears to me that that information must be being mined and compiled, and I would suspect being sold. So I don't know if you're aware of businesses that actually sell this information as a general rule that they get from their consumers, and maybe that's an issue that we ought to take up and try to address whether or not consumers have a right to say whether or not the retailers they deal with or the people in the public have a right to sell their personal information to someone else. Can you have a comment about that?
Representative Holvey, members of the committee, I think that that's an important issue. And I think that what we've kind of heard here, and this is quite kind of why we're thinking this could probably be fixed, it might take a week, is to address exactly those things. And on something like this, to make sure there are tight sideboards, might be requirements for security, might be some type of certification, might be what can be taken, might be prohibitions on sales. But I think you're right. I think the concern here is that this information not be taken and split off and sold. And I don't think that's the intent of the program that's being talked about here. And I think that's the kind of thing that we really ought to look at building into something like this bill and maybe others as they come up. You know, I don't know if it can be done holistically just because there's so many variations. But I don't think anyone has any problems whatsoever with this bill being reworked to make it pretty rigorous, frankly, and protective. It's very, very difficult to get into a situation these days where there is not any electronic information going back and forth. And I think the key is maybe to address it up front through a bill like this to say it's very clear what can be done, what can't be done, and built in the proper safeguards. And I think that's the key to this bill. So there will never be ever an instance where something is absolutely foolproof, because fools are so ingenious. And this is, we just have to build in all the sideboards we can. I think that's the intent here, to do this. And I think it might take a week or so. And I don't know if there's anything really pressing to get the bill in a hurry. And I'm reasonably optimistic that could be done.
Thank you. I know my committee wishes I probably hurried a little bit more so far this session, but man, I didn't know you were so funny. So,
thank you.
He was looking at you.
Is there any other questions from the committee at this time? I appreciate your comments, and I'm hopeful that we can continue this conversation, and certainly I'd like to facilitate a conversation about this bill and some of the underlying issues it's trying to address to make sure we're going down the right road here. I appreciate your concerns, but I also very much am concerned about the issue this bill is trying to address. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on House Bill 2371?
After the grilling lays out, I don't
know
that.
Not the one to keep their personal data.
Seeing that no one else to testify, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2371. And I will open a public hearing a work session for introduction of committee measures.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 1042, dated 2-17-09. LC 1473, dated 2-10-09. LC 2842, dated 2-10-09.
Thank you. Representative Riley has moved LCs 1042, 1473, 2842 be introduced as committee bills. Committee, this doesn't obligate you to support or oppose the bills, simply for the introduction of legislation to possibly be considered. Any objections? Seeing none, they're so adopted. With that, I'll close the work session.
The work is done.
And committee on Friday. What are we doing? I don't think we're going to be ready for this last one.
Are you?
We will carry over House Bill 2326. And I don't remember. Did it look like we'd have 2369 ready?
Sounds like Monday.
Yeah.
Sounds like Monday?
Monday.
I like the sounds of that.
No Friday meeting? Is that what I mean?
That's what they're trying to say, yes.
I know what it was. I mean,
we're seeing. Put in your vote.
Have you looked at your agenda for Monday?
We can go until 6 o'clock.
Chair Hobie, are you saying have a good weekend?
Yeah. We'll carry over House Bill 2326 and 2369 till Monday.
Oh.
And committee, we will cancel our meeting on Friday.
We promise we vote fast.
With that,
I have to reschedule my program.
Two questions apiece with a 1-minute answer.
Well, I think we can get that. We will close. We will adjourn the Committee on Consumer Protection.